WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. LL Cool J is a rapper who has had commercial success and longevity. He's had 6 platinum records and won 2 Grammys since he made his recording debut in 1984 at the age of 16. His first record was the first release for Def Jam, which became the leading hip-hop production company. One of the records he's best known for, I Need Love, was the first rap love ballad to become a hit. LL Cool J also stars in the sitcom In the House, which started on NBC and moved to UPN. And now he has a new memoir called I Make My Own Rules. After his mother left her violent husband, they lived with his grandparents in Queens, New York. When LL Cool J was just 11, his grandparents bought him 2 turntables and a mixer so he could make demo tapes at home. His first hit, I Need a Beat, grew out of one of those home tapes. Let's hear it. LL Cool J, welcome to Fresh Air.
Thank you very much.
You were still in high school, I think, when this record came out.
Yeah, I was 16 years old.
So what was it like, you know, going to high school and having a hit record at the same time?
It was funny because it was a lot of jealousy. A lot of guys tried to pick on me. A lot of people tried to tell me, oh, you're not going to make it. You're lying. That's not your record. You're not telling the truth. I went through a lot of different things, but I felt like I wanted to persevere. I said, you know what? This music is for me. I like it. I enjoy it. I appreciate being able to express myself artistically, and I kept at it. But it was interesting, you know, because I got to a point where I was focusing more on the music than I was on my schoolwork, which in the long run didn't benefit me that greatly. You know, it was cool that I concentrated on the music, and it was cool that I made a decision to go after it because it did end up being something that I definitely, a good thing in my life. However, if I would have concentrated in school more, I think a lot of things that happened financially, especially during the middle years so far, like a few years ago, wouldn't have happened if I had concentrated more in school. So it's interesting for kids, you know, they can want to be stars and they can want to be popular and they can want to make music and do all these things. But if you don't get an education, it's not going to benefit you anyway. Because at the end of the day, you can't trust the people around you to make decisions for you. You have to be able to make the decisions yourself.
Well, I think your grandmother gave you an ultimatum when you were in high school. Either you stay in school or you get out of the house.
She did.
So you ended up leaving the house. And you say you were homeless for a couple of weeks and you slept on the trains for a while until...
Yeah, I did.
Didn't you have any money yet?
No, I didn't. Actually, what happened was I recorded my first song. It did okay. And after I stopped doing the shows, I didn't have any income. So I had no money. I remember getting a room in Brooklyn that was $40 a week and struggling to keep it, you know, because it was just so hard to, you know, pay that $40 a week. And we had, you know, a bathroom that everybody in the town, in the brownstone shared. But it was real tough. So no, the finances weren't there. The finances didn't really come until the first album.
Okay.
And even then, I didn't know what to do with the money. So it was, you know, it's kind of a strange paradox. You know, I started, you know, doing different things and doing different shows. But because of the people that I was involved with and the people that were involved with my financial and economic life, I didn't, and myself, of course, I didn't benefit, you know, greatly from, you know, the money that was generated.
It sounds like early on you spent the money on cars and just really showy, flashy things.
Yeah, I did. I think that my focus was a little lost. I was kind of caught up in the materialistic aspect of, you know, making music and being an entertainer. Gold chains were real important to me. you know, cars were real important to me. Young ladies were real important to me. Champagne was real important to me. All of the negative things, you know, the things that, well, I wouldn't say that all of those things are negative, but in the context that I was, you know, utilizing them or being involved in them, they were negative. So it was rough for me, but I kind of came through it, you know.
Now, tell me how you feel when you look back at old photos of yourself and see a picture of you with that really thick, big gold chain.
The really thick, big gold chain.
Yeah.
You know, it's funny and it's humorous, but it was in style at the time. I mean, you know, it's like John Travolta looking back at that white suit in Saturday Night Fever. It was bananas. It was ridiculous. You know what I'm saying? But
I feel like if you had come to me and asked, I could have told you it was going to look really dated eventually.
Yeah, I would have went with the jeans and t-shirt thing. That might have worked back then. But you know, hey, we live and learn.
So tell me how you kind of created your style in terms of your image, your look early on.
Well, what it was it wasn't even me creating my style. It was like I would go up to Jamaica Avenue, which was the place to shop in Queens, in the area that I lived, and I would buy the clothes that every other teenager bought and every other teenager wore, and I would just happen to be wearing them on TV or wearing them on an album cover. And then when I started generating some money, I was able to buy some of the things that most would consider luxuries at the time, the gold chains, the car, the extras, the new sneakers, you know, the extra hat. And, you know, that's all I did, you know. And then it became, because I was at the forefront of a new music movement or one of the people involved at the beginning, it became like a trend-setting fashion thing. But I never planned for it to be like that.
How did the hat become so important to you?
I don't know. You know, growing up, like when I talk about it in the book, I really just had a complex. I thought I looked cooler with my hat. Never wanted to take it off no matter what. We'd get in arguments, get kicked out of class because I didn't want to take my hat off. I was just really insecure and had to have my hat on. And that was one of the biggest things about, you know, this book, as silly and as crazy as it sounds to even me now, you know, I really didn't want to take my hat off back then.
You had like the first big rap ballad, I Need Love. What made you think of doing a rap ballad? Rap is, for the most part, a music that's either about, you know, bragging how great you are, how tough you are, or how good you are at making love. But there aren't a lot of, like, love ballads within the genre.
That was funny. I think that, for me, I always looked at rap music as a way to express, a vehicle to express my feelings and my emotions. You know, coming from a abusive childhood, rap music was a thing that helped me to feel empowered. It helped me to kind of feel a sense of power and a sense of self-worth that I wasn't feeling at home or wasn't feeling when I wasn't involved with rap music. So this art was an escape for me. I Need Love was just another expression of that. I was 17, 18 years old, and I really felt like I needed love. I felt like love was important. Being, you know, having gone through all the things that I had gone through, and I never looked at it as a opportunity to humble myself. I never looked at it as a chance to do something soft or sensitive. I just looked at it as a way to express my emotions, my sincere emotions, and on an artistic level. So I did what I really felt inside.
You know, in your book, you say that in a way, this record was a risk because you could have looked soft. And I was wondering, gee, well, what about, you know, like Smokey Robinson and Marvin Gaye and Al Green?
It's
all
funny.
The kind of great aching ballads of soul music and rhythm and blues.
Yeah. I never felt like I could look soft. I think that at the time, a lot of people around me felt like there was some chance of this record making, you know, me look soft or something like that. But that's something that never really entered my mind. I never really was concerned with that. You know, I had no fear when I did it. And I just put it out there.
Well, this is LL Cool J, I Need Love.
When I'm alone in my room, sometimes I stare at the wall, and in the back of my mind, I hear my conscience call, telling me I need a girl who's as sweet as a dove. For the first time in my life, I see I need love. There I was, giggling about the games that I had played with many hearts, and I'm not saying no names. Then the thought occurred, teardrops made my eyes burn, cause I said to myself, look what you've done to her. I can feel it inside, I can't explain how it feels. All I know is that I'm never dishing of the raw deal, playing make-believe, pretending that I'm true, holding in in my laugh as I say that I love you, saying I'm more, kissing you on the ear, whispering I love you and I'll always be here. Although I often reminisce, I can't believe that I found a desire for true love floating around inside my soul, because my soul is cold. One half of me deserves to be this way till I'm old, but the other half needs affection and joy and the warmth that is created by a girl and a boy. I need love.
LL Cool J recorded in 1987, I Need Love, and he's my guest, and he also has a new book, which is called I Make My Own Rules. You know, it's interesting, you say in your book that there was a period of your career that when you were on tour, the tours were more like whoring, that, you know, that there was just like so much sex whoring. You were having with, you know.
A lot of whoring.
Yeah, with women waiting for you backstage and everybody wanted you. And I think, you know, that some of the rappers, and you're probably in this category, became so famous, so quick, so young, and were so unused to having money and fame and admiration and all of that, that they just went wild.
You know what I really think? I think that it goes above and beyond. I don't think that this is a cultural issue or an economic issue, because I think that whether you're white, black, Asian, Latin, it doesn't matter. I think the reality is anytime you take a young person and put them in a position of power or supposed power, too soon, too quickly, give them a lot of admiration, you know, some money to play with, and some women grabbing at them, or some men grabbing at them, according to if it's a girl. It's a dangerous thing, because you don't have the maturity to handle it, and you have a tendency to act irresponsibly. And I think that that's what happened. I think that all musicians go through this. I think that especially ones that come in young, whether you're a rock musician or, you know, a reggae musician or a soul singer. I think it's just one of those things that comes with the territory, unless you had someone to kind of steer you in a different direction.
And I guess you didn't have that.
Not at that point, I didn't.
Mm-hmm. Did you expect in several years to hear from women who say that you're the father of their children? You know, to have those kind of celebrated lawsuits?
You're not going to send me one, are you?
No.
All right.
that was not the motivation behind the question.
I know. I'm just teasing with you. No, I tried to be as responsible as I could in terms of things like that. And I hope that never happens. And you know, what else can I say? You know, I've thought about it, though. It's definitely went across my mind a few times. Like, man, I wonder if somebody's going to come up to me with, like, 10-year-old triplets talking about, man,
right.
Yeah, this is eeny, meeny, and miny, and they're your kids, and I want to check.
Eeny, meeny, and miny, Jay. No.
Ridiculous.
You know, one of the people in your group was actually sentenced to 10 years for sexually assaulting.
No. That was a security guard who was working on a tour.
So he wasn't really in your.
No, he wasn't.
Okay.
No, he wasn't.
Nevertheless, he was. Kind of in your entourage.
Yeah.
And
yeah,
he was sentenced to 10 years for sexually assaulting a 15-year-old who had won a radio contest, and the prize
something
was
like
a backstage pass to see you. What was your reaction when you found out
I
that
felt,
happened?
I was appalled, and, you know, I hope that psychologically she recovered, you know. I wasn't there. I wasn't involved. So, you know, what can I say? All I can say is that it's wrong to abuse anyone. And me coming from a background of child abuse, I know that you don't want to be abused. I don't know whether the young lady was there. I don't know whether it really happened. I don't know what the situation was. All I know is that, you know, the courts decided that the gentleman was guilty.
My guest is rap star LL Cool J. He has a new memoir called I Make My Own Rules. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. Back with LL Cool J. He's written a new autobiography called I Make My Own Rules. There are some rap concerts that end up with you know, gunfire. I mean, one of the first rap concerts you went to, there was a gunshot.
The first.
Okay, Sugar Hill Gang?
Yep.
So I'm wondering.
Well, it wasn't the Sugar Hill Gang. It was actually at the Harlem Armory, and it was a festival type show. So there were a lot of groups.
Right.
I don't want to just say Sugar Hill Gang and make it sound like they were the guys, because these, you know, it wasn't like that. It was like a festival show.
Right. Okay.
A lot of different groups.
Mm-hmm. I'm wondering if you've ever felt in danger yourself while you were on stage, if you ever felt that the crowd or individuals within the crowd were becoming or could become very violent.
Well, you know, it's funny. You know, I think that rap music on a whole, as a whole, it's very different according to where you're performing, who's performing, what rap artists, what group. Different groups attract a different element. Have I ever felt like I was endangered? No. Have I had a lot of violence at my concerts? No, because usually my concerts are a lot of young ladies, nice mixture of people, nice mixture in the crowd, and, you know, it's usually peaceful. But I can understand how some parents sometimes can be concerned with rap concerts. But when, you know, LL Cool J has a concert, I try to make sure that there's the best security. I try to make sure that we use reputable promoters that are going to get the proper insurance and get the proper buildings and have the proper metal detectors and the proper security system so that we can do everything we can to avoid these problems. You know, violence exists whether you have a concert or not all over the world. But when people come to a concert, I think they deserve at least, you know, to be made to feel, at least they deserve to feel safe. So I try to make sure, you know, I do everything I can to make sure they're safe. After that, I can do no more. What they do in the parking lot, you can't control. What people do on their way home, you can't control. But I try to make sure that they are as safe as possible when they're in an LL Cool J concert.
A few years ago, E Love of your group was shot by, I think, a chain snatcher outside of a club.
That was a totally separate incident. He wasn't a member of my group contractually, but he was my man, you know. He was a guy that was part of my group early days. But that was many, many years ago.
Was that just a random?
I don't, that was a separate incident. I don't even know the details of that, you know. I know a lot of people who got shot. I mean, we all know there's a lot of violence, but I mean, none of these things, you know, I hate to associate them with my music and associate mm-hmm. them with my art. I think that, you know, on a violent level, I can describe a lot of scenarios of violence that have taken place, even things that I've seen in the news. But just because, you know, I know these people, I don't want to, like, give the impression that, you know, that has anything to do with the music. I think that that's, when you get into violence and you start talking about who got shot and where, those are economic issues, those are psychological issues that go beyond music.
You know, I think in rap music, the earlier rappers are always seen with, a degree of ambivalence, you know, either like you're old school and you're washed up or like you're one of the original rappers and like you're really a god because of that. So, I mean, I think the value seems to go up and down, and you've been in the music for really a long time. You're one of the people who've really endured. What are some of the ways that you've seen rap change over the years?
Well, I think that as far as like, either, you know, disrespecting the guys or thinking they're God, I do neither. You know, just, you know, my decision is just to respect people for what they've accomplished and respect the doors that they've opened, because I think that artists stand on the shoulders of other artists. So when I look at old school rappers and when I look at rappers who helped pioneer the music, that's how I look at it. Hey, you opened the door up for me, and I appreciate that. As far as them being gods, never. You know, I would never idolize a man or woman. As far as what I've done, I've tried to spiritually correct myself. I've tried to be grounded. I've tried to give out the kind of energy I want to receive. I've tried to do things in a way that I can feel comfortable with. You know, I have a camp for kids, Camp Cool J, and different things like that that I do that help me sleep at night and help me get through the day and feel like I'm, you know, making an impression on the world as positive.
You have changed your public image, and I imagine changed your life a lot as well. You're on TV now, and in the house, you have a much more family kind of image. And you know, in your new book, you give advice to young people about how to, you know, not make the kinds of mistakes that you made, and so on. How did you start changing your image? Do you think that there was like a turning point in your life where you wanted to change?
Well, first, let me say this. It's not an image, because an image is something that can melt. That's a facade. That's something that's superficial. It's external. You know, my existence, I exist on an internal level.
I get what you're saying. You changed your life and not your image.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. You know okay. what I'm saying?
So did you have a turning point for that change?
Yeah, I did. You know, when back in like 91, met a gentleman named Charles Fisher. He gave me a lot of insight, gave me some spiritual doctrine. I read it. I felt good about it. It made me feel better. It made me realize how much of a important factor God was in my life. And I kept reading more and more and more and started getting more into karma and the laws of the universe and how important it is to treat people right and my responsibility to the youth of the world to kind of provide some sort of role model for them so that I can make their lives easier. He helped me to get more in touch with the human family and my human side, my soul, so to speak. And I thought that was important. And it was like a realization for me because it was something that I always felt, always tried to be generous. You know, and this isn't about me worshiping Charles Fisher. This is about me saying that the knowledge and the wisdom and the understanding that he helped me to achieve in certain areas really has a strong reflection on what I'm doing today and right now in terms of the people in the world.
LL Cool J has a new CD called Phenomenon, which will be released next month. His new memoir is called I Make My Own Rules, which is also the title of his record on the soundtrack of the Howard Stern movie Private Parts. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.